Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Everything You Need to Know About the Enforcement of the ADA But We're Afraid to Ask conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your host for today's conference, Mrs. Jackie. Jackie, you may begin.
Hi. Welcome to the 2008-2009 ADA Audio Conference Series. The Audio Conference Series is a collaborative effort of the National Network of Regional ADA Centers, also known as DIBTECs, Disability and Business Technical Assistance Centers. You may locate the center that serves your state by visiting www.adata.org or by calling 1-800-949-4232. The centers are funded by the U.S. Department of Education, National Institute on Disability Research and Rehabilitation, NIDER. Today's session is being recorded, and the recording, along with a text transcript, will be available in 10 to 14 business days at the audio conference website, ada-audio.org. In addition to participants on the telephone, we also have people using audio streaming through their computers and individuals using real-time text captioning. My name is Jackie Brennan, and today's session is titled Everything You Need to Know About the Enforcement of the ADA, But We're Afraid to Ask, and today's speaker is Aaron McCullough. Aaron is a serious professional with a sense of humor. He's the youngest of four children, and he still resents never getting to pick what television shows he wanted to watch growing up in a one television household. Aaron is a proud Texan transplant, but retains a love of the Ozark region where he grew up. He's an attorney and a consultant focusing on civil rights law. Aaron is also an experienced lecturer on civil rights compliance with a 5-year record of never boring a participant to sleep. But, you know, that was before today, so we'll see how this goes. He's building his own law practice and consulting with a number of governmental entities and architecture firms and other law firms. Aaron's going to talk a little bit, and then we're going to break for questions, and then he'll talk some more, and we'll break for more questions. So we'll have sort of two question periods during his presentation. So with that, Aaron, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Hello. We're obviously having some technical difficulties, and we have lost our speaker momentarily, so we are trying to regain contact with our speaker and also with Jackie. Not exactly sure.
Okay,
what
he's
had
calling
happened.
Back in.
Oh, apparently his line had dropped off, so he's going to be calling back in just momentarily. While we're waiting for Aaron to rejoin us, just a quick reminder to folks about some of the upcoming sessions we have going on. In December, we'll be getting an update from the U.S. Access Board on their rulemaking for Sections 255 under the Telecommunications Act and Section 508 under the Rehabilitation Act. Those regulations have been updated, so we'll get a status report from the Access Board. And then beginning in January, we have an exciting 4-part employment session that we will embark on, beginning with the January session, which will focus on telecommuting as a reasonable accommodation under the ADA.
Well, Peter, oh. I'm back, and
all right,
Aaron, I'm sorry, folks. I'm assuming that you didn't hear anything that I said after.
No,
that,
they didn't hear anything
after that beautiful introduction by Jackie. I often make the excuse for myself that I went to law school, not math school, and apparently I didn't go to phone school either. So I will apologize, folks, for wasting a few minutes of your time, but I know that I trust that Peter gave you some additional information about future telecasts. Let me reiterate what I said when I was speaking to a dead phone for a few minutes. Again, I want to thank the Div Tax for bringing me here. I also want to assure you that we're going to give you every opportunity to ask your questions. I really like this type of training, and my first opportunity to do a training on enforcing your rights was actually driven by a group of advocates affiliated with the Center for Independent Living here in Texas. They had a very aggressive self-advocacy training cadre that they were bringing up in their community. That group had directly requested a specific type of training, and that was to be exposed to a legal perspective on the nuts and bolts of enforcing the Americans with Disabilities Act. So this was truly drawn from the community, and that group, I believe, has went on to be one of the more effective group of advocates and self-advocates in the state of Texas, achieving a great deal of improvement in accessibility in their communities and building good relationships with the school districts, the city, the county, the transportation authorities, and the various cross-disability organizations. So this is something I really enjoy to do, and I'll try to express my enjoyment over the phone and make up for my gaffe of speaking again into a dead phone. So going back to the original purpose, undoubtedly, the Americans with Disabilities Act has a reputation for being hyper-technical. Undoubtedly, the Americans with Disabilities Act has failed to achieve everything that a person with a disability and advocates for people with disabilities would wish that it had in the 18 years that it's been extant. But undoubtedly, the Americans with Disabilities Act has caused a huge amount of improvement in some basic accessibility. There's a long way to go, and part of that is to embolden the community of people with disabilities to pursue their own rights. I'm going to give you a little bit of a civics lesson that I think is kind of important to place this in context. Think of it like this. In the 20th century, we had a sweep of civil rights regulations that increased the coverage of the Constitution across groups that had previously not been protected under the Constitution. Women were accorded the right to vote with the passage of the Civil Rights Act. People of color, other national origin, and people despite their gender were protected against certain discrimination. But what was missing? Again, we had this sweep of civil rights acts, basically in the second half of the 20th century. Well, there were any number of groups, power minorities, if you will, that were not covered by the sweep of that law, but a key group were people with disabilities. And so shortly after the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, you had a culture of folks who were experienced in civil rights advocacy, had an expectation of expanding protection of the Constitution, but nevertheless weren't covered. So you ended up with the same type of advocacy that I think drove the Civil Rights Act in the for those advocates of people with disabilities and those advocates with disabilities to get the passage of the Rehabilitation Act in the 70s. The Rehabilitation Act, as most of you probably know, again, covers the behavior of the federal government and those people who receive direct federal financing to provide access to programs and services and, of course, facilities funded by federal money. But this, again, left out a huge amount of protection, basically the gap that the Americans with Disabilities Act filled in. The ADA, and again, I'm sure most of you know this, the ADA is an omnibus civil rights act. It sought to achieve all the gap filling left by the Rehabilitation Act. The Americans with Disabilities Act is a huge law that draws from this deep history of civil rights legislation and regulation to, again, protect people with disabilities from discrimination. Without getting too technical, again, this covers people with regards to employment, with regards to access to state and local governmental entities, and we'll talk about what those are in the programs and services offered by those state and local governmental entities, as well as access to private sector businesses and commercial facilities that are open to the public, as well as a few other niceties, such as providing access to telecommunications and protection against retaliation. So this was a bold law that was passed, and the expectancy of the people with disabilities was that this was going to fix everything. And I think the promise of that has not been delivered. And part of that is because, again, there's been a great deal of litigation. I think particularly in the early and mid 90s. If it wasn't for criminal appeals before the Supreme Court or Native American land grant issues or Bureau of Land Management lawsuits, the biggest and most common issue in front of the Supreme Court was the Americans with Disabilities Act. And that's to a certain extent to be expected because, again, we have a new set of laws that purports to do a whole lot of things and move towards a sea change in the way that people with disabilities are able to access the world around them. Okay. So, again, more specifically, the Americans with Disabilities Act protects people in accessing their community and accessing employment and accessing transportation. But how is it enforced? I think what gets buried in the most obvious part of the Americans with Disabilities Act is the fact that it is a civil rights law. All too often in the minds of, let's say, city planners, even in the minds of some advocates, this is what I've heard referred to as a, quote, a wheelchair ordinance or a braille sign ordinance. They tend to think of these things as local or building code related. The built environment aspects of the Americans with Disabilities Act and the accessibility guidelines that flowed from that law that were these regulations created are obviously the most obvious change that has occurred. Most new construction, at least that construction that is well-funded, at least tries to comply somewhat with the Americans with Disabilities Act. A significant amount of remodeling at least makes that effort to comply with the Americans with Disabilities Act. And we'll discuss perhaps later why they may fail. But again, what is getting lost in the mix is that this is a Civil Rights Act, and a Civil Rights Act is only enforced two ways. A Civil Rights Act is enforced through complaint to appropriate federal or state agencies or through private lawsuits brought by covered individuals against entities that are covered under the law. And so while there may have been a great deal of initial concern on the part of, let's say, county governments and school districts to assess their ready level of accessibility early in the process, and there may actually have been some action towards making their programs and services, for example, accessible. And there may have been a great deal of concern in the small business community on what they needed to do, and so you saw some patchwork approach to making existing facilities accessible. And again, I think a more successful bit of compliance with regards to newly constructed facilities. But again, that is the affirmative compliance. These are the folks, the agencies that decided to comply. And those that fall short, those that delay, those that ignore for whatever reason their obligation to comply, all too often are not going to comply unless, one, they get complained against, and they receive a notice of that complaint from, again, the appropriate federal agency, in some cases state agencies, or two, they're sued by, again, a person with a disability. So, and I can't emphasize this enough, But I do empathize with the fact that that seems to be a complicated process. Well, that's what we're here to discuss. And I want you to come up with a lot of really good questions, but I'm going to kind of thumbnail, I'm definitely going to thumbnail for you the mechanisms of compliance. We're going to start with a discussion of employment, what Title I of the Americans with Disabilities Act is, and we're going to talk about Title II just a little bit under there. And we're going to break for questions after that. Then we're going to talk about accessing the programs and services and facilities of state and local governmental entities and accessing those places of public accommodation and commercial facilities or those private businesses and facilities open to the public after that and break for another round of questions. I think that's how that's going to work. So let me get into the meat of the discussion. I'm sure many of you, if not most of you, know that the Americans with Disabilities Act is broken up into titles, and we've already referenced those. Think of them as chapters in the book that is the Americans with Disabilities Act, and each one covers a discrete portion of that omnibus Civil Rights Act. Title I provides the vast majority of the employment protection information under the Americans with Disabilities Act. There are some complications under Title II, and we'll talk a little bit about that. Title I, or the employment provisions of the ADA, first of all, cover people in the application process for employment, cover them in the interview process of employment, and hiring during the course of their employment and enjoying the benefits of their employment. So at all stages of employment, Title I has some input. Well, who's covered by the Title I? What type of employers are covered? Well, the vast majority of private employers are covered under Title I of the Americans with Disabilities Act, as well as the vast majority of public employers at the state and local governmental level. Federal employers, for the most part, are not covered under Title I. They are covered under Title I of the Americans with Disabilities Act. They're covered under the Rehabilitation Act. There are discrete parts of the government, including the Congress, which are covered under the Americans with Disabilities Act, Title I. Now, Native American employers that are clearly, part of a tribal-owned businesses on a Native American reservation are not covered, and private employees that have less than 15 employees, private employers, rather, that have less than 15 employees are not covered under the Act. And I get asked this all under Title I of the Americans with Disabilities Act under most circumstances, and I get asked this all the time. Where did this number come from? The 15 or fewer employers, or 15 or more employer number, is drawn out of Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. It's drawn from previous legislation and regulatory law that basically established that employers that are this small may not be able to muster the kind of professional human resource services that would be required to comply with this law. It's also about, to a certain amount of logic, about how most small businesses start and prosper and grow into larger businesses. The vast majority of small businesses are generally staffed by family. And to a certain extent, again, I think this somewhat arbitrary number was placed at that point to respect how most small businesses start. Now, again, I said under most circumstances, it's 15 or more employers in the public sector to be covered under the Americans with Disabilities Act Title I. There are some exceptions. First of all, you may have a standalone state statute where you live that mirrors the ADA. In fact, may actually borrow the language or incorporate by reference the Americans with Disabilities Act Title I. However, there may be amendments, and in fact, in any number of states there are, where they cover smaller private employers. for example, Arkansas has a basically parallel set of civil rights protections for people with disabilities in employment in the private sector, but instead of a cutoff of 15, they have a cutoff of 6. In addition, you may have state compacts with the federal government where you have a similar set of laws, but in fact, excuse me, I'm losing my voice, but in fact the number has been reduced. I believe New Mexico is parked at 6 or 8. I can't speak to all the states, but you may have a state with an agreement with the EEOC where they have parallel jurisdiction. However, they have agreed to cover, or they have adopted that set of protections that mirror the ADA, but again extend the coverage to smaller employer sets. Okay, and we can talk more in detail about that if you have questions specifically. Like I said, in addition to the provisions under Title I, there are some protection for employees under Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act. And we're going to go into detail about what Title II is. But again, Title II provides access to the programs and services of state or local governmental entities. State or local governmental entities, as defined under the Americans with Disabilities Act, are basically any state or local government authority, anyone acting under the authority of the state or local governmental entity. So it's not the federal government, it's not a tribal government, but it can be anything from your legislature to the governor's office to your county judges to your city aldermen, all the way down to the programs and services offered by the Parks Commission, all the way to animal control. Again, essentially any program or service that's offered by less than the federal government, but it is an elected or appointed governmental body or a program offered by them. So it's a pretty broad set of protections. There have been any number of situations where you have smaller governments. For example, I'll use, I believe, Hereford, Texas. Hereford, Texas is a small panhandle Texas town that has a mayor, a constable, a couple of city clerks, some part-time janitorial staff, as well as some contract labor that is truly independent contractors and would probably fail the EEOC test for employees. They have far fewer than the 15 employees necessary to become vulnerable under Title I of the Americans with Disabilities Act. However, the Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act has covered those employees of public entities even when there are fewer than 15 under certain circumstances. However, this is an issue of controversy. In fact, we have what we call a circuit split in the Court of Appeals. We have decisions holding in the 2nd, 4th, 5th, 9th, and 11th Circuit that have dealt with these issues, and there is a certain amount of split. Even in the 9th Circuit, there's what we would call an inter-circuit split. There's a difference in interpretation on whether or not Congress intended to have this cover employees. There may be an opportunity, so we encourage even those folks who are working for a small state agency or a small city organization who have nevertheless been discriminated against on the basis of their disability to endeavor to protect their right. And, in fact, they may be within a circuit that's not made a decision or a circuit that's made a decision and, again, supports their rights under Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act. That's all pretty hyper-technical, and I want to get to the meat of it. I mentioned earlier that there's only two ways that the Americans with Disabilities Act are enforced, and that's through complaint to federal agency and through private lawsuits. Title I is a little more complicated than the other titles with regards to filing a complaint and filing a lawsuit. The relevant federal agency under most circumstances for filing your complaint of employment discrimination is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, or what you may know as the EEOC. There are regional field offices across the country where you can file a complaint if you've been discriminated against on the basis of disability. And I have to say this: the second prong of enforcement is, of course, a private lawsuit. Under Title I only, you have to file with the EEOC under most circumstances in order to get to the point where you can file a lawsuit in federal court. Now, this isn't just a mere formality. You have to what they call exhausting your administrative remedies. Now, in no way is the EEOC capable of entertaining, investigating, and making a determination on every complaint of discrimination that comes in front of them. Often the EEOC will direct a complainant to the fact that they can hire a private attorney. Now, they're not going to necessarily make referrals to private attorneys, although that has been known to happen. But under those set of circumstances, often if someone has engaged the services of an attorney, you still have to file the complaint. And again, I'm going to kind of walk you through this. I'm going to walk you through the complaint process, then I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the litigation. You've been discriminated against as an employee. You're pretty clear that you're covered under the Americans with Disabilities Act as a person with a disability. The definition of disability is an entirely different lecture, but let's assume you're clearly covered under the Americans with Disabilities Act. Your employer has more than 15 employees. You have documented the nature of the disability discrimination. You have some evidence on your side. You've started to collect and print the emails where relevant. You've kept your documentation, any letters that you've been sent. You have to gather up all that information. You need to begin to create a paper trail. And you need to file your complaint in a timely manner with the EEOC. Under most circumstances, your deadline for filing a complaint with the EEOC is 180 days or approximately 6 months. Under, again, most circumstances, if you file your complaint 9 months or a year later, you've lost your opportunity to file a complaint with the EEOC unless you can convince them why you did not timely file. In most circumstances, they're not going to entertain the nature of the complaint. So again, think of that as a hard deadline in most jurisdictions. However, again, in some states, in some localities where there are agreements with these local collateral jurisdiction agencies, you may have an opportunity to extend that to as long as 300 days, for example. So you want to make sure that you file it timely. I'm going to encourage you that your evidence is going to tend to disappear, but if for whatever reason you've been eclipsed from doing so, or you haven't felt emboldened to do so, or you found new evidence suggesting that your dismissal was, for example, based on disability animus, you might want to check and ensure that you do not have that extra time. But under most circumstances, if you know you've been discriminated against, you want to get in and file your complaint as soon as possible. Now, I mentioned that you can also hire an attorney and file a complaint in federal, or rather file a lawsuit in federal court. You need to do so also in a timely manner. Now, sometimes when you hire an attorney, they will file the complaint for you and ask for what they call a right to sue letter, what's euphemistically known as a right to sue letter. And it just becomes a formality to file the case with the EEOC, and they will fairly quickly issue a right to sue letter to you, and your attorney can act on that. Under certain circumstances, you may file a complaint. The EEOC may investigate or may not be able to investigate, to be honest, and after a period of time, as long as, in some cases, 200, 300 days or more, they may issue a right to sue letter. Understand that you have deadlines then. Under most circumstances, once you've been issued a right to sue letter, you have to file your lawsuit within 30 days in federal court. And I'll entertain some questions about that a little bit later. But you need to kind of keep in mind those two deadlines, 180 days from the date of the discrimination on the employment provisions under most circumstances to file your complaint. Once you've filed your complaint, whatever avenue you're going through, once you receive that right to sue letter, you have 30 days under most circumstances, again, to file a lawsuit. Excuse me. So let's talk a little bit about the complaint process. The EEOC, for the most part, is staffed by investigators and employee law attorneys, who I think are some of the finest and, to be honest, most dedicated civil rights attorneys on the planet. However, they're way outnumbered and by the number of complaints, and way understaffed under certain circumstances. And I'll provide for an example. Think about all the pending EEOC complaints in the Gulf Coast region during the Katrina Rita hurricane disasters. And then think about the amount of people that got displaced, federal courts that got shut down, federal agencies that got shut down, federal attorneys and investigators relocated, as well as those complainants relocated to other parts of the country. And for the most part, those expanded Gulf Coast EEOC agencies tried to absorb that. And I'm sure this has occurred in Florida and California and other places where there tends to be long-term and devastating natural disasters. That tended to push, to be honest, the ability for those offices to receive and honestly investigate cases out the door. Now, undoubtedly, they did their best, and they did pursue any number of cases, but all too often they merely issued, after a cursory investigation, the right to sue letter, and dropped that on a vast majority of people who may already be displaced. So I want to encourage you again to definitely file a complaint again with the EEOC if you feel that you've been discriminated against. At very least, if you feel that you've been discriminated against and you cannot afford the services of an attorney and you cannot get an attorney to agree to take you on a contingency fee basis, you ought to consider filing the complaint regardless. We're going to talk a little bit about the complaint process, but I want to talk to you about why you should file a complaint. If you don't file a complaint, you will not get any justice on the basis of your disability discrimination claim. Again, the only way that this is enforced is through your lawsuit and through your complaint. The EEOC, on their website, EEOC.gov, have made it abundantly clear how to contact your local EEOC office, your local Disability and Business Technical Assistance Center, or your regional ADA Center can certainly provide you with some information on how to contact them. All of the regional ADA Center's websites have information on filing a complaint of employment discrimination, and it's very specific information that can walk you through the process and provide you with some guidance on what you have to do. But I think it's important that you understand why you need to file a complaint, and that's because there's no other way to get the justice that many of you may seek after getting discriminated against. Do we have any questions regarding employment provisions of the ADA and enforcing those rights, Jackie?
Shanavia, can you come back on the line and explain how questions are asked?
Sure. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you have a question, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Again, if you have a question, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. One moment for our first question. And our first question comes from Gary Edler. Your line is now open.
Okay. does the ACLU or the Legal Aid Society act as attorneys for the disabled in any of these private lawsuits, or can they?
I'm going to restate the question and make sure that I got this right. I think the question was, do any of the legal aid societies act as attorneys with regards to workplace discrimination cases? And that's actually a really good question, because you ran right into a point that I had failed to make. Under most circumstances, your local legal aid organizations will probably not entertain civil rights issues. Increasingly, they're focusing more on access to health care, protection of women against violent spouses and boyfriends, immigration issues, and housing issues. However, in every state of the union, and even in our territories, we have organizations called protection and advocacy organizations. In the state of Texas, it's Advocacy Incorporated. In other states, it's going to be similarly named. There's a national association of protection and advocacy called NAPAS that can provide a listing for you, and I do believe that's NAPAS.org, NAPAS.org, that can provide you with access to your information about your local protection and advocacy. And I'll explain shortly what protection advocacy organizations are. They are organizations that are funded to protect the rights of people with disabilities with regards to a lot of laws, including the Americans with Disabilities Act. And, again, these are some of the most dedicated and finest civil rights attorneys that I know. Jackie used to be one. However, you've got to look at certain realities. You can certainly contact them and see whether they would be interested in entertaining a complaint and taking a case. But do not be surprised if they cannot do so, because they just basically don't have the resources. I think the state of Texas has fewer than 10 attorneys for a state with over 20 million people in it. You know, arguably, you know, a certain percentage of those, I think Texas claims about a 13% disability rate, who are disabled. They can't respond to this sheer tumult of complaints that they get. And, again, they have obligations to protect the rights of people under various, usually various grants, including those issues dealing with, for example, school law concerns at times, as well as developmental disabilities, the rights of institutionalized persons. And so I think they're an enormously effective resource, not only because they might take your complaint, but any number of them do network with some private attorneys who are a little more flexible, perhaps, in their willingness to take cases of this type. But I'm going to tell you, with regards to Title I of the Americans with Disabilities Act, you're going to find more attorneys willing to litigate under the employment provisions, because it's more familiar to them. Not only is the employment aspects of the ADA the most complained and the most litigated part of the ADA because of how important employment is, but also because there's a willingness of attorneys to take it, because the employment discrimination provisions of the ADA may be different than those under other civil rights acts, including Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, but the language of the ADA was largely borrowed from them, so there's a comfort level. The vast majority of employment discrimination plaintiffs' firms will consider a good ADA case, particularly if there's been retaliation, or you can tie it into an age discrimination issue as well. So again, I wouldn't totally discourage you from seeking on employment discrimination the private sector, but again, it is the private sector, and inevitably it's going to cost some money. I hope that answered your question, caller.
How about the ACLU?
The ACLU focuses on civil liberties issues, and the difference between civil rights and civil liberties is a long, is a big different lecture. The ACLU has developed some good resources on civil rights concerns, and I'm sure that there's been some local ACLU offices that have engaged in some civil rights work, but for the most part, they focus on other constitutional protections.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you. Our next question comes from Captioner. Your line is open.
Hello, this is the Captioner. I have a question from ADA8. Let's see. Would a large retail agency like Walmart, who are requiring applications to be done online, in violation of Title I?
And the question I got is, for example, you got a large box retailer that's, that appears to be requiring that applications be conducted online, which may put a lot of barriers up for a lot of people with disabilities. Would that be covered under Title I? Assuming that they didn't accommodate a real need of somebody with a disability that was unable to utilize that service because of a disability, then it would be covered under Title I of the Americans with Disabilities Act, because again, you're protected in application, in the interview process, in hiring, and in your employment. I hope that answered your question.
Thank
Any
you.
Other questions?
Our next question comes from Lisa Justice. Your line is now open. Ms. Justice? If your phone is on mute, please unmute it. Okay,
and don't feel bad, I did that.
I guess we'll go to our next question.
But get back in the queue, Justice.
Our next question comes from Martha White. Your line is now open.
Springfield.
Hello? Martha White?
We don't have a question.
Oh, we don't have one.
Okay.
Okay.
Our next question comes from Debbie Jackson. Your line is now open.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. We were just curious because you were talking about the deadlines for filing your complaints. And if an employee has a cognitive or a psychological disability and doesn't understand and misses a deadline, what happens in that case?
That's an interesting issue. I'm going to say under most circumstances, if they miss a deadline, they're going to miss a deadline. I mean, you might convince the EEOC that's the case, but I'm going to tell you under most circumstances they're going to stick to the 180 or the extended deadline.
Okay, even if somebody has a head injury and they can't. And they didn't understand that there was a deadline, and then they tried to file. You don't think that they would?
I'm going to tell you, under most circumstances, no, and that's because at a certain point it creates an injustice even to the other side. At a certain point, why would an employer need to keep that information? Witnesses disappear, move on, and their lives die. In fact, and there's a reason why we have statutory deadlines that kind of drive procedure. So I'm going to, as empathetic as I am, I'm going to tell you under most circumstances, they're going to stick to the 180 days. Now, again, that's from the date of the discrimination, and that's just, understand that that's a discrete discrimination. There are circumstances where the discrimination is ongoing. Someone hasn't, for example, been terminated. Someone wasn't just denied one time an accommodation, so there may be an opportunity to revisit under those circumstances. I don't tell people to go back and get in. No, actually, I do tell people go back and get discriminated against again. it's kind of an awkward way to put it, but there may be an opportunity with regards to some rights and some types of discrimination where you can go back and unring the bell and start the tolling over again. But I encourage people, that's why I encourage people to get on this soon. If you feel that you've been wronged and maybe you have some cognitive issues related to, say, the head injury, then I would encourage you to work with an advocate who maybe can identify that you have been discriminated against or you may have been discriminated against. If it feels, and this is why I say that you need to be willing to file a complaint so that you're prepared to get on this as an issue. If you need some assistance to a certain extent, within the deadline, the EEOC can assist you. They can take complaints over the phone, fax, email. You know, if they're not too busy of an office, they may even schedule a face-to-face, which may help somebody, you know, to be honest, make their case of complaint. But it, under most circumstances, they're going to hold you to the deadline.
I hope
that answers your question.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Lisa Justice. Your line is now open.
I'm glad you got here, Ms. Justice.
My name is Jessica. I'm at the Ability Center in Toledo where Lisa Justice organized for us to participate in this.
Okay.
I wanted to go back to something you were saying about it's not a formality to file with the EEOC first, but sometimes you actually make it so that it is a formality because all you really want is to get the right to sue letter because you really want to file a lawsuit.
For example, let's say you've got a clear-cut case of discrimination, you've got great evidence on your side, and you're not poor, okay? And I hate to be blunt, but you've got the 10 grand or the 5 grand to drop in front of a really high-quality employment discrimination attorney. You've archived all your emails. You've got good letters. You've got somebody who's got pending complaints against them. And so it's kind of waiting out through the EEOC's investigation process is just delaying the inevitable. So either you can ask for the right to sue letter, assuming that you've retained the services of an attorney or assure that you can within 30 days, or you can have your attorney make that request for you. And so it becomes just something of a formality. And that's something I've done with other attorneys. It's just, we used to wait for the investigation under certain circumstances because it allowed the employers to tip their hand a little bit. But the employers have gotten fairly savvy and we find when I'm working with some firms, they've made the decision that discovery is a better process for getting this done and getting it started soon. Because, again, if you wait for the right to sue letter to come from the EEOC, it may take a long time. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the captioner.
I want to say this is probably the last question we can take on this so that we have time to finish out the rest of the topic.
Thank you, Jackie.
Okay, no problem.
This is a question from ADA7. The question is, why doesn't the ADA have more teeth, i.e. regulations and penalties for businesses?
This sounds more like a Title III question. Did you get that, Jackie? I didn't quite hear that.
Yeah. Well, yes. Sounds like something you'll be covering in a moment.
I'm pretty sure I'll be covering that in a moment, and if I don't get into that, then I'm going to encourage you to re-queue and ask that question again because it sounds like not an employment question but a question about penalties and remedies against Title III entities. And, again, we didn't really go into remedies a lot with regards to employment because, again, I'm going to tell you the whole Title I discussion is multiple, hour-and-a-half-long webcasts, or rather teleconferences. But typical remedies are compliance, potential back pay, et cetera, the same kind of remedies that you'll tend to see under Title VII discrimination cases, Title VII employment discrimination cases, on race-based, gender-based issues as well, with the notable exception of the right to be reasonably accommodated, which is unique to Title I of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Okay, we're going to move on to Title II and Title III of the ADA. And these have some interesting, I think, some procedural components that I verified recently with the Department of Justice. As I mentioned earlier, Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act covers people with disabilities and their against discrimination in accessing the programs and services of state and local governmental entities. Again, anything that is an elected or appointed governmental body that's not the federal government or Native American government, under most circumstances, is a Title II entity. And the protection is about accessing those programs and services, and this is going to include facilities under most circumstances, but understand we're not talking about total access. We're talking about accessing the programs and services in a meaningful and comparable way to those people without disabilities. This is a huge obligation for Title II entities, and it covers there's some specific regulations that go along with those general protections, such as the obligation to, you know, back in the early 90s, to turn in a curb cut and sidewalk plan to promote an accessible pedestrian infrastructure within municipalities, the obligation to make transportation services accessible, including the creation of complementary demand response public transportation services like paratransit services. So it governs a huge amount of the behavior of state and local governmental entities, and there's really not a single part of your state or county or city government that isn't touched by the Americans with Disabilities Act Title II and Title III, or Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act. I'm going to talk to you about Title III as well. This was probably the biggest achievement of the Americans with Disabilities Act, was to extend the protection of discrimination outside of government into the private sector the way that the 1964 Civil Rights Act did. So this covers any business that's open to the public and any commercial facility that's open to the public. So everything from retail centers, large box retailers, professional offices, including dentists and doctors and attorneys and accountants, recreational facilities such as bowling alleys and, let's say, private golf courses under most circumstances. And the only real exclusions that are out there are for those things that are, under most circumstances, private clubs, those private clubs that satisfy the IRS definition of what a private club is. So those organizations like the Elks, the Shriners, the Order of the Eastern Star, to a certain extent country clubs, although country clubs become vulnerable depending on their behavior and whether or not they actually lease their facilities or provide access to the general public outside of a core of pure membership. And there's a great deal of exemption for religious entities with respect to the facilities owned by, for example, churches. Now, again, under state law, you may reach into these types of facilities in ways that the federal law doesn't. For example, the Americans with Disabilities Act accessibility guidelines is not going to affect or is not going to cover the construction, the design and construction of a church, of a place of worship. However, under state law, the Texas Architectural Barriers Act, for example, and the ADA Equivalent Anti-Discrimination Act under Texas law, you're going to find that there are going to be aspects of that design and construction that are going to fall underneath these under this coverage. So the only thing that's specifically excluded is the portion of the facility that's part of worship, but those more public areas are going to be covered under the law, but that's a state law issue. So as you can see, this is where the rubber meets the road, to be honest. this is where most people think of what the ADA is trying to achieve, and to a certain extent the ADA did achieve, was provide this broader access to the way that we live our daily lives. You know, it is shopping, paying taxes, going to public educational settings, taking advantage of public transportation at times, accessing private transportation as covered under Title III of the ADA. I'm really thumbnailing this for you because there's a lot of specifics. Now, this is part of the same set of Civil Rights Acts. So the only way that you can enforce your right to access state and local governmental programs and services and access those public those businesses open to the public and those private and public transportation services and ensure that you're not that your rights are going to be respected when you've been discriminated against is to file a complaint with the appropriate agency, usually federal but often a parallel state agency, or file a lawsuit. And again, there's a remedies discussion here, but which I think is more appropriate for a longer, lengthier ADA primer, for example. But we'll talk a little bit about remedies. Okay. Well, I advise you that under most circumstances, you default to the EEOC under employment. With regards to enforcing your rights under Title II and Title III, you've got a lot more choices with regards to enforcement. The primary agency for enforcing your rights under Title II and Title III is the Department of Justice, the U.S. Department of Justice, who promulgated most of the regs that breathe life into this part of the ADA. They have their own complaints process, and I'm going to walk you through this with some examples. And then I'm going to talk to you about transportation and education, which are separate animals, and then leave enough time, hopefully, for some questions. The U.S. Department of Justice is going to take complaints of the nature of when you've been denied access to the programs and services of a state and local governmental entity or a Title II entity. They have a process for receiving complaints. They have a very specific complaint form that you can download or fill out online at usdoj.gov. Now, the handout that I gave that should be attached to this lecture posting on the teleconference site provides, I think, more specific information about the address, the fax number, and the web address for filing Title II complaints. And essentially the Title II complaint is asking, the Title II complaint form is asking you to provide the kind of specific information that will give the U.S. Department of Justice enough information to be interested in pursuing it. It's asking the who, what, when, and where of the nature of the discrimination. And again, I'm going to encourage you that if you feel that you've been discriminated in, say, accessing your public library because they're not providing services that are accessible to you because the stacks are on the second floor and they're not staffed adequately to pull books that you've requested or provide some other way for you to access those services. Or there's a blanket prohibition against somebody with a developmental disability from partaking in, the services of a local, let's say, swimming program at a public pool. These are the types of things that you can file a complaint with the U.S. Department of Justice about. They're going to want you to very specifically indicate who you are, who the person with a disability is, if they're not the ones who are filing the complaint, the contact information of the person filing the complaint and assisting the person filing the complaint. They're going to want to know the whoever you contacted within, let's say, that city recreational or that parks program on swimming. They're going to want you to give a timeline of facts. If you've got photos that support your claim or you've got emails or letters that support your claim, they want you to attach copies of that. And they have, again, a pretty specific checklist of questions they want you to answer so that they are armed with enough information to pursue the claim. Similarly, under Title III, under many and I think most circumstances, the Department of Justice will take a complaint where you've been denied access to businesses that are open to the public or those public accommodations and those commercial facilities that hold themselves open for business. If you've been discriminated against on the basis of your disability, similarly, you can file a complaint with the U.S. Department of Justice. You don't have to fill out that specific form, but following that guideline is actually an excellent model. It's probably better that you endeavor to solve this outside of that process. But, and I tell you this because I tell you this for a variety of reasons. One, you may find that you can solve this without a complaint or a lawsuit. That's always the best. But in trying to solve this, for example, negotiating with a private business. And communicating with them, for example, through writing or email, you are creating the paper trail that may provide you with the kind of evidence of discrimination that you need to file a complaint that's going to catch the notice of the U.S. Department of Justice. Now, I mentioned, you know, equipping them with enough information to be interested. I mentioned catching the notice of the U.S. Department of Justice. Imagine every potential complaint an actual, you know, against a state or local governmental entity that's denied access to a person with disability, and every potential complaint against every restaurant, bar, club, recreational facility that has denied access to a person with a disability, either through act or through omission, through, let's say, not properly constructing their facility to be accessible, or accommodating a person with a disability in other ways so they can access those goods and services. Imagine the potential of complaints. Now, the actuality is there's a lot of complaints. And in no way is the U.S. Department of Justice able or staffed enough to entertain all those complaints. So you're better if you stand a better chance of getting them to take your complaint seriously if you take your complaint seriously and you provide the kind of documentation. So, again, the paper trail, the emails, the letters, being polite, tempered in tone, but sending things certified mail tends to get people's attention. It also provides you with evidence that they receive the nature of your concern. And if they fail to respond in, let's say, a timely manner, then that's additional evidence that you can put in your narrative when you're sending your complaint to the Department of Justice. And, again, there's information about how to file a Title III complaint linked on their website, and I've provided you with the link to that website in the materials that are attached to this teleconference. Now, this is an interesting issue. Understanding that there's no way they can take all the complaints, why should you endeavor to make a complaint? Because, again, as I indicated, if you don't do it, it's not going to happen. The only way that you can enforce your rights is to file a complaint or file a lawsuit. Now, here's an interesting issue. What about filing Title II and Title III lawsuits? Well, there are far fewer attorneys that will entertain Title II and Title III lawsuits, but that doesn't mean that there aren't any. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about that. I mentioned the protection and advocacy organizations in each and every state and territory. And again, they are equipped and charged with taking complaints about Americans with Disabilities Act violations. They're under no obligation to take every case or investigate every case. But the better your case is, let's say the more widespread its potential effect, even better if you get more of your peers with disabilities to sign on and provide additional evidence, you might interest the protection and advocacy in taking your case and trying to reconcile the discrimination with the parties involved and or file a lawsuit. So, again, more reason to think of your discrimination in the complaint mode to protect the kind of evidence that you would need to file a complaint to support the someone in potentially representing you in a lawsuit. Now, again, I mentioned the private sector are a little bit less likely to take this case, and that's to a certain extent to be expected because these aspects of the Americans with Disabilities Act, this part of the law is not drawn from, is not as much drawn from previous civil rights legislation and regulatory law. These are the unique provisions of the Americans with Disabilities Act that distinguish it from other, you know, omnibus civil rights act like the 1964 Civil Rights Act and other amendments. And to be honest, there aren't that many attorneys who are very familiar with the requirements under Title II and Title III, besides those that work for, let's say, civil rights projects or protection and advocacy organizations. But there are some that do specialize in broader civil – well, who do take broader civil rights claims. And so you might be lucky enough to live in a state with an excellent attorney. I don't name them, the ones that I know, because they've got enough people who are referring to them right at the moment. But, again, you might be able to represent – you might be able to find an attorney. Now, I understand this. It is the private sector in all likelihood. They're going to want some sort of remuneration. They're working for a living as well. This is why one strategy that I know people have taken is to work with cross-disability organizations or discrete disability organizations to help support those private sector attorneys who might be otherwise unwilling to take a case. It's expensive to file a federal lawsuit, and so a lot of the upfront costs asked for, or a lot of the upfront retainer that's asked for is to cover those initial costs and ensure that the attorney is at least going to get paid for a great deal of the initial work. Under certain circumstances, nonprofits are unable to, say, for example, use the attorneys that they have in California to handle a case in, let's say, South Carolina, but they might marshal the support with let's say the national and the regional organizations to put together enough funding to support a private attorney in taking that case in South Carolina. So if you're an active member of a cross disability organization or a discrete disability rights organization, you might consider working with their working with those groups to again identify like-minded attorneys in the private sector who would be more willing to take the cases. Again, there are circumstances where attorneys will just take this, will take that and bear the cost of the litigation, but they're few and far between, and I'm not one of them, because again, it's expensive. Okay, where are we at? I think we're going to entertain some questions.
All right. Do we have any questions, Shanavia?
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you have a question, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key.
Aaron, before we take any more questions from our phone participants, I have one that was submitted online. And also, just real quickly, the folks can also access the Title II complaint form and how to file the Title III complaint form going to the ADA.gov website. And the question that was submitted online wants to ask, why are zoning ordinances exempt from coverage under Title II of the ADA?
They're not. zoning ordinances are potentially covered under the Americans with Disabilities Act if they are going to tend to create a situation where people with disabilities are discriminated against, then those ordinances may, in fact, be unlawful. And so you may just be getting shined on by a local official. And I hope that answers the question of the online online questioner. And if that doesn't, please send another email. Next question.
And on the phone lines, our first question comes from the captioner. Your line is now open.
This comes from ADA 7. I am writing a paper on gas station assistance that the ADA calls for gas stations to provide for people with disabilities. Why aren't businesses penalized for complying with the ADA? Why doesn't the ADA have more teeth?
Okay, that's a good question. Somebody's got a particular issue under the, let's say, Title III of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and they're disappointed that under this that there's less affirmative compliance, that there's less voluntary compliance. In this case, it's a issues surrounding gas stations and I'm assuming assisting patrons with disabilities on those self-serve centers. And the questioner is, you know, roughly concerned with why doesn't the ADA emphasize, if I try to emphasize something I haven't done enough, is that the ADA isn't an organization. The ADA is a civil rights law. So unless you file complaints and file lawsuits to enforce those rights, under a lot of circumstances, they're not going to get respected. And this is one of those. On a single staff, 18 pump convenience store that's on a busy corner and a lot of turnaround, all too often the needs of an individual with a disability who needs assistance in pumping gas is going to be missed or actually ignored. And if it is actually ignored, and you can document that, and it's fairly easy to document, get somebody with a video camera to and date stamp it and show you attempting to get help, and provide that information in your complaint that you have this evidence. Write a letter to the owner, let's say of a local franchise, and ask them why they didn't provide this service. See if they give you anything back. If they give you anything back, then attach that a copy of that information, that email or that letter, in your complaint. That's the only way this is going to get enforced, is if you file complaints and file a lawsuit. And I understand your outrage, but again, you need to channel your outrage into pursuing enforcement. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Chuck Bow. Your line is now open.
Yeah, or a different thread or something in it. In terms of denial service, though, the ones that I've always thought were kind of most interesting, because these are the ones you really don't realize you're doing until it's done,
yeah.
And that is that whenever you'd have a theater group perform at the Commons, for instance, or on the theater,
uh-huh.
They would call people up to the stage.
Okay.
Your line is open. Are you asking a question?
If you're handicapped, you
operator, why don't we go to the next question?
Get up there.
No problem. Our next question comes from the line of Lisa Justice. Your line is open.
My question is, under the Title III, shouldn't all affinity have a proper accommodation? I mean, like, I know I understand that new affinity who built new building should always have a proper accommodation, but should the old accommodation?
That's a great question, and I hear this all the time. A lot of people are chilled, as I call it, from filing complaints against a business that's in an existing building because they get told that this has been grandfathered, that this is too old of a facility for us to have to comply with the ADA. And as everybody at the ADA, regional ADA centers, the DIPTACs like to say, there ain't no such thing as the grandfather clause with regards to the Americans with Disabilities Act. There may be a limited amount of architectural modifications that a business that's open to the public has to provide, but they need to find a way and be willing to have a policy in place to provide access to the goods and services that they offer. And there's a variety of strategies to meet that. And, again, that's a complicated discussion, I think, for another teleconference. But understand that an outright denial and they refuse to do something because it's an old facility is probably a violation of Title III of the ADA. You just need to find a way to document it. Now, I want to take another question or two, and then I want to close with a little bit of discussion of some procedure around complaints and litigation under Title II and Title III. So do we got another couple of questions in the pipe?
Yes. Our next question comes from Martha White. Your line is now open.
Hi. This is Norma Mateo. I have a question regarding the Title III, the ADA and religious entities. You say it's, it doesn't cover religious entities. However, if they rent to a community agency, is that covered and to what extent?
That's an interesting issue. If they start using their facility, let's say, as a public meeting hall, it's arguable if they rent it to, let's say, a member of their congregation for a wedding. But if they started allowing people to use this as like an entertainment facility, particularly with some of the larger, let's say, mega or mesa churches that have large recreational facilities. We've got one in Houston that has a McDonald's on campus, for example. It's hard to argue that church that has a McDonald's on campus isn't somewhat vulnerable under Title III, and in fact they are. If they're truly acting as a landlord or a lessor and leasing this to public access, then they have some responsibilities to provide accessibility. But so do the people who are leasing the facility or using the facility. So if it's, let's say, a nonprofit organization that's utilizing the facility, that's a joint obligation. I hope that answers your question. Next question.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Eric. Rick Edwards, your line is now open.
Thanks. Earlier you said that there were a number of ways to file a complaint under Title II. Can you go into some of those? Because
We're kind of running out of time, and I'm glad I was going to cover some of that, and so I'm glad that we closed with that question. Now, I mentioned that, you know, I mentioned state and local governmental entities, and I mentioned private businesses, and we mentioned transportation a little bit, and I promised to get to that, and education. There are a number of responsive investigative agencies under the Americans with Disabilities Act that that can receive complaints. There should be a link to those investigative agencies on the handout that's attached to the form. If you have an issue with regards to access to public transportation or private transportation, you may want to file that complaint with the Department of Transportation, for example. A complaint against about an educational entity can be filed with the U.S. Department of Education. Again, there are a number of investigative agencies responsible under Title II and Title III of the Americans with Disabilities Act. However, I've had this verified by the responsive offices on civil rights in most of those organizations. You could potentially file anything but an employment case or a complaint to the Department of Agriculture, their Office on Civil Rights, and they have one. But if it's not appropriately placed there, they will forward it to the appropriate governmental entity. I encourage you under most circumstances to file it with the appropriate federal agency. And again, the handout that we have kind of marches you through the most common application of where you file your complaint when. And it even includes some discussion outside the scope of this lecture where we talk about access to federal facilities, for example. So, again, I'm gonna encourage you to defer to that handout for most of your regular situations. And it should be fairly specific. And I checked all the links and the phone numbers and addresses last week, so that should be very up-to-date. Now, I want to before we close, I want to do something that I admitted. I want to talk to you about the complaint process under Title II and Title III. Again, the complaint process for Title II, a complaint against state and local governmental entities, is so much more precise. And there is that form that the Department of Justice wants you to fill out. In addition, there is a deadline for filing your complaints with your Title II complaints with the U.S. Department of Justice. They want you to file your complaints within 180 days of the date of discrimination where you've been denied access to a state or local governmental entity's programs or services. And in talking to, let's say, the Department of Justice's ADA helpline, to clarify the point, unlike employment where you may have a discrimination that terminates your employment, that gives you a hard deadline for when you start tolling those 180 days, under most circumstances, when you've been denied access to a program or service of a state or local governmental entity, you're going to want to file that complaint very early. But if you've been chilled for whatever reason, I'm going to encourage you this. Go back and get discriminated against again. I know that sounds horrible, but if it's access to a local facility, if where a program's offered, if it's a denial to participate again in that that recreational swimming program for any child with a developmental disability, that child's still going to be developmentally disabled 6-9 months later when you ran past the tolling date. You can make a reapplication, get discriminated against again if this is something that you're still offended by. And again, I know that sounds awkward. I'm not encouraging people to go and create discrimination opportunities, but where you've been chilled, misinformed, or just really haven't gotten sufficiently comfortable with the notion of pursuing this until you've missed that deadline, under a lot of circumstances, you can unring that bell. Now, undoubtedly, there's some single denial issues that'll never come up again. You need to file your complaints as soon as possible, just because that because again, people will disappear, be transferred, records will be destroyed, etc. It's always better to be fresher off the nature of the discrimination into the complaint. There is no such limitation on the Title III complaints. However, again, if you're talking to the U.S. Department of Justice, they'd prefer you do it within 30 days. Because the same set of facts are potentially there, people may move on, records may be destroyed, the ownership of a facility may change, and you run the risk of having a complaint be moot because something has changed because you failed to pursue the complaint. Now the limits of your ability to file a lawsuit under Title II and Title III are vastly different than Title I with regards to employment. The U.S. Department of Justice has issued regs where you are going to look to the local jurisdiction law on statute of limitations with regards to how long you have to file a complaint, or rather file a lawsuit. And so let's say under a typical statute of limitations for a civil complaint in state court in many states is 2 years. Under certain state schemes, civil rights complaints have a longer or shorter statute of limitations. So again, with regards to your ability to file a lawsuit, it's still better to do so in a timely manner because of all those realities that we discussed. But you may again extend that period from 180 days to as long as 2 years or 3 years or more. But under most circumstances, no. It's always better to pursue this earlier. And there's nothing more disheartening to me than to have the damning letter, the perfect piece of evidence from the offender where they've denied access to a place of public accommodation and done so boldly and obnoxiously, and then you look at the date on the letter and it's 3 years ago, and you understand that it's way past the statute of limitation. When you have all the evidence you need to pursue your case right in front of you on a single piece of paper, but you can't because the time is told. So, again, I encourage you to be timely. Moreover, I encourage you to think about discrimination from a complaint's potential. What do you have to do to protect your rights if you cannot resolve this outside of complaints or a litigation arena? You have to document, create the paper trail. Don't provide another reason for denial. I know it sounds horrible to ask people to be temperate when they've been denied a basic essential right, but I encourage you to make the other person look like the jerk. try to render everything into writing. Even if you talk to someone on the phone or through relay, try to follow up with a letter or an email discussing the nature of the phone call. Try to get people to give you records. If they won't, it may just put them on notice that you're serious about enforcing your own rights. Now, I know we didn't get to a lot of questions, but this was kind of a big issue to discuss.
Right.
I encourage you, if you have follow-up questions, you can contact your local ADA center. And again, I want to thank everybody and hand this over to Jackie for the close.
All right. Thank you so much to everybody who joined us, and we will get those questions answered. And also want to thank Aaron for being the speaker today on such a really a big topic to try to fit into such a small amount of time. As you all saw, very difficult to do. So, you know, please do call your call or email your DIBTAC ADA center that's nearest to you. Please join us next month for an update from the Access Board on their Section 255 and Section 508 regulations. The session will be December 16th from 1 to 2:30 Central Standard Time. For information on this session and the rest of the 2008-2009 schedule, call toll-free 877-232-1990 or visit ada-audio.org.
Jake, I just wanted to mention, if people do have questions, the number for the ADA Center is 800-949-4232, or people can visit www.adata.org to find the center that serves their state.
Right. All right. Thanks. Bye, everybody.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's conference. This concludes the program. You may now disconnect.